Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Thorne Mooney, and we will be talking about her new book, Traditional Wicca, A Seeker's Guide. While there are many powerful variations of contemporary witchcraft, traditional Wicca offers unique experiences for those who seek it out. This book explores structured, coven-based styles of Wicca, in which the practitioners typically trace initiatory lineages back to Wicca's early founders. Discussing covens, initiations, lineages, practices, ethics, and more, traditional Wicca shares tips and ideas on how to get the most from this profound approach to witchcraft. Thorne's book is available at Amazon.com, and you can also find out more by visiting her website, which is thornthewitch.wordpress.com. And I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Thorne to the show. Good day, Thorne.
Hi, Robert. Nice to be here.
Thank you. I'm happy to have you with us today, too, and talk about Wicca and some of the traditional and also some of the myths and misconceptions people may have about it. So first, let me start with, would you explain to the listeners just a little bit about your journey and how it is that you became interested in Wicca?
Sure. Well, in a lot of ways, my story is very typical. It was the mid-90s, and we were living in something of a media witch craze, and I was a teenage girl. The Craft came out in 1996. Charmed came out in 1997. Buffy the Vampire Slayer came out in 1997. Practical Magic came out in 1998. So there were witches everywhere. And I was the target demographic. I was a girl in middle school and then into high school. And, everybody said that the witchcraft that was happening in these shows and movies was actually based on something that was real. And the internet was a new thing. So we were able to get online for the first time and kind of look this stuff up. And it was really entrancing. So in that way, the things that the media always warns you about were actually true. I was led into witchcraft by movies and TV.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, a lot of those shows that you referenced, they really put witchcraft and, Wicca and, just the arts in a very different light. I mean, it was,
sure.
It wasn't that dark, burning with the stake type of approach.
Mm-hmm.
So
it was powerful and shifty, right?
Yeah, well, it made it, approachable, I guess is the word I was thinking of, as far as
mm-hmm.
people like yourself who might want to explore. So, it's, the name of your book is called Traditional Wicca. So how does that differ from, non-traditional Wicca?
So, one of the things that people eventually find out when they start exploring Wicca and witchcraft traditions broadly is that there are so many. People often talk about it singularly. They'll talk about witches or they'll talk about Wicca as though it's one thing. And I discovered when I was young and getting into this that there were all these different strains, and some of them were solitary and were very kind of eclectic and do-it-yourself, and then others were coven-based. Some of these traditions had names, and it was very overwhelming. So for my purposes and the purposes of the book, I've defined traditional Wicca as Wicca that is coven-based and hierarchical, which means that there's actually an order to the coven. There's a leader and students arranged in a particular order, lineaged in the sense that members can trace their beliefs and their teachings back usually to a particular founder. Also, I've defined it as experiential, meaning that we're striving to have direct experiences with the gods. And also initiatory, which is really a cornerstone, this idea that brought in formally through ritual. There are lots of other kinds of Wicca that entail simply exploring on your own, and you can simply declare yourself a member. But our particular traditions, you have to be brought in by somebody else.
Okay. Wow. There's a lot to learn from that. Well, first of all, with the idea of there being so many variations, I believe, like you say, there are a lot of people out there like myself who didn't realize the variety of, of options, I guess, or variations of practice. Mm-hmm. So, let's start with the idea of the coven. You know, since you talked about it being a coven based, can you explain to people what a coven is and its specific purpose?
Sure. So a coven is a group of witches that practice together, just at its most simple level. And if we look at other traditions, it could be a group of friends, it could be study partners. Generally speaking, this is a group of people who have a very strong bond together that's built up over a period of time practicing. I've described my coven mates as feeling a lot like brothers and sisters. And the idea is that they're learning together and they're practicing together. And there's a high priestess and a high priest who, generally speaking, are leading the coven and have the most experience. And they're disseminating what they know to the people in their group. So in that sense, it's also a little bit like a classroom environment where you get people coming in who are wanting to know more. And they get to learn through a structure provided by the coven itself. So it's a great system for folks who don't necessarily want to do all of the exploring alone. They like having partners to work with. It's great for social folks. And these are very small, intimate groups for the most part. My coven has 7 people in it. It's pretty rare to see groups that have more than about 10. So we're talking about small groups here.
Okay. So it's kind of like, the structured aspect, you know, the way that you describe it, it sounds like, you know, just a small, specific group, set up, to further their knowledge, within that group. When it comes to practices, what is the primary benefit of being in a coven, the ability to have, those within the coven to be able to help further understanding? Is there power in numbers, so to speak?
Absolutely. So there's definitely that social benefit that's pretty simple. You always have folks to talk to, and you always have folks who are potentially more knowledgeable to bounce ideas off of, but there's also a magical benefit. There's this idea that, well, if one witch is powerful, then a group of witches surely is more powerful. That seems pretty straightforward. So one of the cool things about being in a coven is that you're working together, you're getting to know each other on an energetic level, and you guys, when you come together and you focus on similar goals, it's that many more people working toward the same thing. So theoretically, a coven working together is more powerful than a lone witch. Whether or not this actually happens in practice totally depends on the coven itself, but theoretically, that's one of the benefits too.
Okay, so now when it comes to the members of a coven, it's not. I believe you mentioned that you kind of have to be invited to join. Is that correct, or do you have individuals from outside requesting to join?
So usually people make requests. The specific term that you'll hear is people become seekers, and they're actually seeking admission into a coven. So if they know that a coven exists in their area, or they know somebody who runs a coven, it would be perfectly reasonable for them to petition that person to be considered as a member. That's usually how it's done. It's very rare that coven leaders will ask people to join. And part of that is because we want people to want to be there. So that means that usually we're looking for people to express that they want to be there.
That makes sense. So when someone petitions to join, is it strictly up to the leader or to the whole group as to whether or not this individual is allowed to join?
It really depends on the coven. On paper, it's up to the leaders of the group. Usually, in Wiccan traditions, the group is run by a high priestess. In an ideal situation, she's also accompanied by a working partner, usually a high priest. But usually there's more than one person in charge in one way or another. And ultimately it's up to them. They're the ones who are hosting the group. They're the ones who are organizing things. It's their party, so to speak. But the fact is, anytime somebody new comes in, everybody's impacted. So personally, I always have conversations with the other folks in my group. I like to get input from everybody because everybody's affected. The ultimate decision lies with me, but if people really express that something is a problem or I feel like their concerns are valid, then I'll go with consensus. I always have. So on paper, it's up to me, but I think that part of good leadership entails making sure that everybody has a voice.
Yeah, well, in particularly that kind of group, I would think energetic resonance would be really important, you know, more so than some groups.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So now you also mentioned a part of a traditional Wicca is initiation. Is that something that happens after an individual is accepted into a coven?
Or is that something different? Usually what happens is if a coven is considering a new member, they will be permitted to circle, to have ritual with them, maybe more casually. They'll use what's called an outer court ritual, which means that the material isn't protected by oath. It's not something that's guarded only for initiates. This might be the kind of ritual that you would see at a public pagan gathering or a festival or something like that, something that's really more about getting to know the person socially and energetically rather than seeing how they operate in these really protected kind of spaces, getting to know the person socially and, you know, seeing how they might fit. And then after a period of time, which varies depending on the coven, then that person would be offered initiation, and that's done ritually. Then they're brought into the coven, and they're a full-fledged member of it.
Okay, so I'm curious now about this outer courts and the privilege. It sounds like, okay, when someone takes an oath, what is the oath? I mean, I would think the oath would be to the group, but I mean, in what sense are they, you know, committing allegiance to?
Yeah, so that's a tricky one, because that's going to vary by the tradition itself. I will say, generally speaking, the oaths that people make are to, usually they are to the tradition itself or to particular gods. They are very rarely oaths to specific people.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you're not swearing to pick up the dry cleaning of your high priest and clean the toilets. That's not what's happening.
Not a gopher.
Yeah, and you're also not swearing about, staying forever and giving up your earthly goods and your firstborn child or something like that. They're much more akin to things like fraternity and sorority oaths, where you're promising to uphold particular ideals, you're promising to uphold a brotherhood or a sisterhood. It's much more akin to something like that.
Okay.
If the tradition works with particular gods, you might make an oath to those gods. So it really varies. But I think one of the reasons why traditional Wicca sounds so scary to people is because they're worried about having to swear over a child or something like that.
You've seen that on TV before,
totally. But it's much more, I mean, doctors make an oath, right? When they finish schooling and begin practice, they make an oath to do no harm, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's much more akin to an oath of ideals and how you're living and how you're going to behave. And then, of course, there is a component of that oath that has to do with maintaining whatever that tradition's secrets are.
Okay.
But I tell people, think of it more like a fraternal oath.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that makes sense. And it's a lot less scary in the sense.
It's way less scary, yeah.
Yeah. One of the things, before we kind of go on a little bit more about the aspects of traditional Wicca, how would you describe Wicca itself as a belief system?
Ooh, that's another tricky one.
okay. Sorry to be throwing so many tricky ones your way here. But.
No, it's great. It's great.
Okay.
So there are going to be, what I want to say first is that there's going to be some difference depending on the practitioner individually, because so much of what we do is about our practices and kind of the liturgy that holds us together rather than necessarily our beliefs. So you might see a lot of variety in what we believe. When I'm defining Wicca, I like to talk more in terms of where it comes from. So Wicca arises in the mid-20th century in England as a result of things that were happening in a broader kind of Western magical movement. So I would describe Wicca as being a Western esoteric mystery tradition. It has direct roots in Hermeticism. So in that sense, we could talk about it as a European occult tradition. But it comes to the U.S. In very roughly the 70s, very roughly. And at the time in the United States, well, we've got the New Age movement bustling. We've got feminism bustling. So we've got all of these other movements. And Wicca coincides really nicely. So Wicca actually kind of collides with the New Age. It collides with the neo-pagan movement, the feminist movement, and it does some interesting things. So I think that American Wicca actually looks a little bit different than European Wicca in some ways. So if an American were to describe it, for example, as a contemporary New Age religion, I don't necessarily think they'd be wrong. I just think it depends on what point they're looking at. So you might also hear that it is an earth-based feminist tradition that's rooted in the worship of a goddess of the moon. That's one perspective. But you might also hear that it is an initiatory mystery tradition that's rooted in the same vein that Freemasonry is, for example, out of Europe. And both are true. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. It does. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's in a way, it's like many belief systems that, you know, it has its roots. Then it has its variations as time goes on and location and in incorporating, you know, various societal changes, you know, as well. So it's kind of like a
absolutely
morphing kind of way that it, you know, that it would.
Totally.
So
like in the United States, for example, I think you see a lot of people describe Wicca as something that is more solitary and it's eclectic and it's all about the individual and how the individual wants to grow spiritually. And I think that that's really unique of Americans. Like, we don't like being told what to do. We really like our individual traditions and, oh, I'm not religious. I'm spiritual. I'm on my own path. Like, our religious history is full of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes perfect sense that our Wicca would be so self-focused. Whereas in other parts of the world, it's going to look a little bit different. So my perspective is that, well, it's all different kinds of Wicca. It all makes sense depending on where you're from. It's just useful for me to have particular terms to describe what we're doing, which is why I'm using traditional Wicca specifically.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. That makes sense. Okay. So now let me get back to some of the traditional aspects. Lineage.
Sure.
You mentioned lineage as being an aspect. So lineage means that individuals can trace their Wiccan history back through the generations, you know, to some founders.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us, is there a how important is lineage in the process or in the practice?
So this is very controversial. In most Wiccan traditions that define themselves as traditions, lineage becomes very important because it's how we determine who belongs and who doesn't, very in the most blunt sort of way of putting it.
Okay.
Somebody who's been initiated can tell you who initiated them, and who initiated them and who initiated them back to whatever point the community thinks is necessary. So, for example, I'm a Gardnerian Wiccan, and Gardnerians can tell you individually where they fit in relation to Gerald Gardner and one of his priestesses. If somebody claims to be a Gardnerian but they can't do that, everybody's going to be suspicious of them.
Okay.
Now that's going to vary from tradition to tradition. Because your lineage is really just where you came from. I mean, your family lineage comes through your parents, your grandparents, etc. And it doesn't really matter whether or not your grandfather was a good guy or not. That's still your lineage. So we all have them. But the reason they become so important magically is there's this idea of passing power. So what you're really trying to do, other than just brag about wherever you came from, which is certainly a thing that people do, what you're really trying to do is justify your authority and where your power comes from. And there's this occult idea that's found in multiple occult traditions, not just Wicca and witchcraft, of, well, my power is coming from this source and it's been passed through these people. In the Catholic Church, we think of it as apostolic succession. This idea of, okay, God has ordained this person and that ordination gets passed and it's all traceable back to God. That's the idea. So in many occult traditions, it's access to particular spirits. In the New Age movement, think about like theosophy and this idea of the ascended masters. It's about access. In Wicca, it has more to do with this idea of shared power. So I can kind of tap into this collective power of my tradition that's available to me because of my lineage. Again, very theoretical. Do I personally believe, right, that lineage witches are necessarily more powerful? Well, no, but I've seen some, I mean, I've seen things personally where I'm like, okay, yeah, there's something to this, but I think people kind of abuse the idea sometimes.
When I was looking at that, it was like, I can recognize the value in a way of being able to document and verify one's lineage back to a particular point in time. I can understand the idea of even the passing of power, the idea of from generation to generation. And one of the things, though, that I thought was, isn't that applied to all of us, in our lineage?
Yeah, well, think about it. So Ancestry is very popular right now. Everybody's getting their DNA
right.
tested. And why is it that we care so much whether or not we've got royalty in our families? Like, why do we talk about that? Nobody cares if their ancestors were potato farmers, right? We want to be able to say something about ourselves because we think on some level it matters. Now, does it really? I don't know. Most of the time, probably not. But we think it tells us something about ourselves, and we're all so interested in self-knowledge, I think, particularly those of us on occult paths.
Yeah. Well, I can understand, some people, I'm related to George Washington, pride in that, But I also see my brother has done our DNA stuff, and it's interesting, the connections that come up,
and
there hasn't been anybody of renown, that we've been able to, attach to. But I think the idea of what we said about knowing more about yourself, and it sounds like, and it seems to me that the value in knowing that lineage or knowing the participants, whether they be potato farmers or be royalty, is the fact that, their genes, have been passed down to you and are in some sense a part of who you are, whether or not you're aware of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think it's one of those things where it often has as much meaning as people put into it. But it's a combination of things. Part of it is verification, right? Can you prove that you belong? Part of it is this idea of passing power and self-knowledge. Then people get vain about it and they lord it over other people, but hopefully that's not what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, and it's, I can understand each of those elements, the abusers of lording it over, and to me, it just, when it comes to lineage, and the idea of whether you belong or not, I guess if it's a closed group, or to begin with that, then it's, important, to, I guess, identify one's legitimacy, so to speak,
sure.
and belonging to the group. But I don't know. I kind of go back and forth on that one. So I'm probably like you do in some sense.
Sure. I will say that I'm proud of my lineage. It's something that I cherish. But it's part of the picture, right? When I talk about it in my book, it's only one thing of the multiple elements I describe. Lineage by itself isn't going to get you anywhere. But lineage coupled with other things and done well, that's another thing entirely.
Okay. All right. Wow, that's great. Well, I'm going to take just a quick break here, Thorne.
Sure.
When we come back, we'll continue on and talk a little bit more about traditional Wicca. So everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., and we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. And before I bring our guest back on, I do want to remind everyone that our show is also, in addition to being available on iTunes, it's also now on TuneIn and also on iHeartRadio. So you can use any of those platforms to access the podcast for free, so I hope you'll join us. Okay, so again, today my very special guest is Thorn Mooney, and we are talking about her book, her new book, Traditional Wicca, A Seeker's Guide. And again, you can find out more, well, first of all, it's available from Amazon.com, and then also if you want to find out more about Thorn, you can visit her website, thornthewitch.wordpress.com. And again, I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Thorn.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, so we just kind of covered lineages. Now, hierarchy. You mentioned, that there's a hierarchy within the organization. First of all, obviously, I would think that the purpose of having a hierarchy is just to maintain order, in a way, as with any organization. But beyond that, is there... any particular reasoning or maybe unique structure with hierarchy that differs from hierarchies we know, or maybe even what happens, if the one at the top, something goes wrong with the one at the top?
Sure. So the analogy that I use in the book is that of a classroom. I'm also a high school teacher, so I draw a lot on that experience. A lot of people get really wigged out at the idea of hierarchy, particularly pagans and magical practitioners, right? We don't like being told what to do. We don't like having bosses.
Yeah.
But hierarchy is really set up in terms of what the practitioners know and how much experience they have in the tradition. So the folks running the group are usually at the top of that hierarchy. Presumably they've been through the training process, their third degrees, or if there is a degree system, they're at the top of it. And their primary role is to preserve the tradition by spreading it to other people and teaching it to other people. So in that sense, that hierarchy is about knowledge and experience. Somebody would necessarily be lower on the hierarchy because they had less experience in the tradition. And usually that's demarcated with a degree system. So usually when somebody's initiated, they earn their first degree. They're usually called first degrees. Most Wiccan traditions have 3 degrees. There are a couple floating around that have 5. So it really depends. But the point of that hierarchy is to lead people up through it so that eventually you are producing people who have the knowledge and experience to go out and start their own covens and be high priests and high priestesses in their own right. So it's not like you're keeping people down permanently. It's not like you never have a chance to be president after 5 years of being voted secretary or treasurer. you're actually being trained to the point where you can go off and start a coven of your own.
Okay, so, that's interesting. So if one is in a coven that's got very distinct lineages, like your gardenerian aspect, would they then, if once they get to that point of being able to start their own, would it be then, I guess, still within under that umbrella as being a just real quick, when they do start their own, do they kind of have to build their own covering? I mean, I would think that it would be quite a process to, you know, I mean, it's kind of you train people to the point of being able to head up their own coven, and then they break off and start their own. So how does that work?
Sure. No, it's tricky. So the process you're talking about is called hiving. When somebody, there's lots of bee analogies. So there's this idea that somebody comes up through the coven, they're elevated through all 3 degrees or however many there are, and then they hive off and they can start their own. And the coven that they start, because they've gone through this process, would be in that same tradition. So, for example, I have an initiate who's been with me for a long time, and she's been with me for however many years. She knows all the things. She's been helping me to run circles. She leads sometimes, and she tells me that she's ready to go off and do her own thing. She's got her 3rd degree, so she would hive. Basically, it's me giving my blessing for her to go off and do her own thing. Just like a kid growing up or graduating and getting their first job. And because she has had it modeled for her in the coven, like, okay, this is how this tradition operates, she's seen how I high priestess. She can make her own decisions about how she wants to do it. Maybe she's not into my style. She's got a different personality. She's going to run things her own way just by virtue of being a different person. But we're going to be carrying out the same rituals, the same liturgy. We're going to be worshiping the same gods. We're going to be using a lot of the same language. It's going to be a gardenerian coven. It's going to have its own style and its own flair just because people can't help but add that stuff. Now, if 10 years down the road she decided that she didn't want to be a gardenerian anymore, she could go and she could train with another tradition, or she could make something up on her own out of books. She could do whatever she wanted. But at that point, she would stop calling it gardenerian.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and people change over the years. People can make their own choices. But the thing that unites us as a tradition is our liturgy.
Right. Now, when that, when she leaves to do her own thing, would all of the rest of the members of your coven stay with you? Or is there a possibility some would go with her if they just had, maybe had a you know, a closer affinity to her?
Sure, it kind of depends on the coven. That certainly happens, it's possible that usually in our particular tradition and in a number of traditions, people are actually trained in pairs. She would already have somebody that she was working with to start her coven with. Usually it's a mixed gender pairing. Usually you have a man and a woman. But the reality, too, is that Wicca attracts a lot more women, and sometimes that just doesn't happen. But you still usually see pairs of people. I hived from my coven with another man, so the two of us went off and started a group. It's usually not just one person out on their lonesome starting things from scratch, although that certainly happens. And at that point, other people who I had initiated, people who were in my group, generally speaking, they would stay with me. But if you got situations where maybe one person really was a better fit for somebody else, then I think it's the responsibility of the coven leader to encourage that person to be with the high priestess or high priest that's going to be the better fit for them.
Okay, Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so it does happen.
Okay. Yeah, it's just curious. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, it's kind of like this budding flower, you know, kind of thing. It's like, you know, then what
lots
happens
of bee
now?
Stuff, I'm telling you.
I'm sorry?
Lots of bee metaphors, I'm telling you.
The hive just buzzing around. Okay. Well, so now, if someone out there listening wants to find a coven, what would you tell them kind of where to begin to even
sure.
do that?
So this is the whole second half of the book. There's a ton of information. Couple of things. First of all, we are blessed with the internet, and the internet is full of all kinds of really specific information that you wouldn't necessarily think was there. A lot of people will get online and they'll just Google Wicca or traditional Wicca or the name of their particular tradition. But you can actually nowadays, you can get online and you can Google your individual city or town. When you Google Charlotte, North Carolina and Wicca, me and my coven pop up. And there are ways that you can contact us. There's an email address. There's all kinds of good stuff. So online is a big one. The site witchvox.com, the witch's voice, was set up in the 90s, and honestly, it really hasn't been updated since the 90s.
okay.
But it's still active, and people really do still post listings there. So I would check out witchvox.com. And there's an area page where if you're in the United States particularly, there's a page for each state, and you can look at ads for both covens and for individuals. That's a great choice. But the best thing to do, I think, is to get out into your local community and go to pagan events. Even if they're not
okay.
Wiccan, even if they're not in the tradition you want, usually there aren't so many pagans in any given spot that they segregate. Usually we all know each other.
Right.
So if there's a druid ritual in town, go to it. If there's some Dianic witchcraft group doing some open moon circle, go to it. get to know as many people as possible and let people know that's what you're looking for. Often traditional Wiccan coven leaders don't do a lot of advertising, but they'll make it clear who they are and where they are to people in the know. So, for example, if you go to the Pagan Pride Days here in the Carolinas and you start asking around for Gardnerians, eventually people will point you my way or to any of the other priestesses in the area just because people know who we are because we get involved in kind of peripheral ways.
Mm-hmm.
So even if the event is not ideal, even if you think you're going to be bored, even if it sounds dumb, go to it. That's what I tell people.
Okay.
Go to
well,
it,
you know,
yeah.
We know. I mean, that makes sense because again, it seems like a very energetic type of grouping, so that you would really want to kind of be there among the group because you can learn so much more by, you know, seeing and being with people in person than just, you know, through the, you know, the anonymous internet.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Your best connections will happen face to face.
Yeah.
And that said, I met my coven on the internet.
I'm sorry, what was that?
So that said, I met my first coven on the internet. So it happens both ways.
Okay. So now, are there any particular precautions that one should take, you know, when out seeking?
Oh, God, yeah. So, especially nowadays, I'm glad we're having so many of these conversations about sexual predators, just because
mm-hmm.
I think as a result of kind of the counterculture in the 60s in the U.S. and the free love movement and feminism, and we have these ideas that religious communities, pagan communities, are immune to that stuff, and we're not. There are absolutely predators. So take all of the same precautions that you would take when you go meet any strangers, when you go to any kind of event, right? I mean, it's a sad
mm-hmm.
state of things, but we still have to... You have to be careful who you give your phone number to. You have to watch your drinks. You have to consume alcohol in moderation, right? Like all of the same rules apply. And I think we tend to let our guards down in magical spaces because we're so excited to finally have other people around us who feel like
mm-hmm.
kindred spirits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you still want to, you know, you still want to wash yourself. That said, overwhelmingly, people are great. So I don't think that it's necessary to be paranoid, but
right.
you want to take all the precautions that you would going to see anybody in public spaces.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You want to make sure a friend knows where you're going. I would really recommend bringing friends with you. And if you're going to meet specific people, if you're going to meet a coven leader for the first time, let them know you're bringing a friend. It's always acceptable. If somebody tells you, no, you have to meet me in this dark spot and you have to come unaccompanied, don't do it.
Yeah.
So they're not as magical as they say they are. Don't do it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good. You know, I mean, it's basic common sense, you know, in today's environment.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right when you talked about, you know, sometimes in those situations, people will let their guard down. I've seen that myself, you know, when people are in what they feel is kind of a safe space, you know, with people with similar kinds of intentions. But you're right, you just never know who is a part of that.
Yeah. The other thing I would add, too, is that traditional Wicca is, it's for adults. I mean, we have kids. We got a lot of moms in my particular coven. I mean, people have children, and people like to involve their children in their home practices, et cetera. But when we're talking about an initiatory priesthood, which is what Wicca is, particularly traditions that practice nudity, et cetera, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
These are not activities for children. So if you see advertisements and they're looking at people who are under 18, that's a huge red flag.
Oh, yeah.
I've definitely seen people in my own community trying to prey on particularly young women, so it absolutely happens. If you see a coven advertising and they don't have an age restriction, that's something to be wary of. And that's a frank conversation that you should have with them. Some traditions and some groups are very welcoming to children and families.
Right.
But most traditional Wiccan groups, particularly groups that practice Skyclad, these are for adults only. And if they don't make that clear, that's something that you might want to be wary of.
Good point. Boy, very good point. Well, is there... any particular topic, you know, or thing that you might want to let listeners know about either traditional Wicca or just in general as far as a practice that we mm-hmm. haven't covered that you would feel would be really good? Maybe, you know, some myths to dispel.
Sure. Well, I think that probably the biggest myth and one of the reasons that I was so keen to write the book was because traditional Wicca has been around for 70-something years, I think people have this idea that we're all, like, elderly, stuck-in-the-mud kind of people who, like, we really don't like change, and we don't like young people, and we don't like new ideas, and we're really restrictive, and that kind of stuff really just isn't true. There's definitely a period, particularly in the 80s and 90s, where I think there was a lot of backlash in traditional Wiccan communities because solitary practices were becoming so prevalent, and the internet made Wicca available to so many new people. So everybody gets a little territorial, right? But what people need to remember is that most of us, I mean, we're in our 30s and 40s. We got people in our 20s, right? Like, we're millennials. We really represent a gamut of ages and experiences. And it varies by region. It varies by tradition. So just because a Gardnerian was mean to you on LiveJournal in 1997 doesn't mean that you were all terrible.
Right.
I think these are very much alive traditions. And they reflect the people who practice them. So just because things were true in the 60s or 70s or those were the prevalent attitudes doesn't mean that that's what's happening now. My coven consists of people who are all under 45. And, you know, we've got all kinds of millennial concerns. And, you know, the traditions change as the people change with them. So our liturgy is the same. Our gods are the same. The tradition holds, but it's still very vibrant. So that was really a point I wanted to get across.
Well, that's good. And the message you want to get the reader to take away from reading traditional Wicca, what might that be?
That there are all different ways to practice Wicca, and I really believe strongly that there aren't right ways. I've been a witch for more than 20 years. I've been a Gardnerian. I've practiced other traditions. I've been eclectic and solitary. I did the teen witch thing in the 90s. And I think that all of these traditions and all of these ways to practice have a lot to offer. And traditional Wicca is just one of them. And it's one that is amazing. And I think that it is going through a revival right now, which is awesome. But I wrote this book particularly to be welcoming and to be inclusive, not to disparage other types of witchcraft. So I hope that people will read it and realize that this is a thing that might be available to them and might be worth exploring, but that it doesn't have to be any kind of dismissal of solitary practice or eclecticism or other kinds of witchcraft traditions. I think we have a lot to offer each other.
Yeah, I agree. And I said that was the last question, but there's one that I forgot. I was thinking, you know, with so much conversation about things happening in contemporary news about things being a witch hunt, you know, does that kind of just roll off, you know, your shoulders, or is it, you know, just perpetuating, you know, some kind of, you know, you know, harken back to an era of persecution.
So I see my own witchcraft as being something that's very distinct from what was going on. For example, people often talk about Salem, and it's funny. I'm actually reading The Crucible right now with my juniors, We're talking about witch hunts. And we talked about some of these comments from Trump and some of the things that are floating around. Well, what really is a witch hunt? What does it do? And I think that the concept of a witch hunt has a lot more to do with fear and irrationality than it does with a contemporary religious movement. So when I hear people talking about witch hunts, while I think that it's an inappropriate term in the sense that, right, like Trump isn't experiencing a witch hunt. Like, I'm sorry, that's just objectively not true.
Okay. I agree with you.
I don't take that, right? Like, I don't take offense as a contemporary witch, though, because I understand that when people use that word, they're not talking about me.
Right.
I don't own the word witch. We don't own the word witch. And I don't think that when people, honestly, I think that word does a lot more to damage, for example, I think it's a lot more harmful in terms of the damage it does to women collectively, just because the idea of a witch hunt really has a lot more to do with targeting women, for example, than it does targeting pagans or targeting Wiccans.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So maybe we could choose better words, but I don't think it's offensive to me as a religious practitioner.
I was just curious because, you know, and I agree with you that, you know, the contemporary use as far as, you know, more fear-based and maybe even a little paranoia, you know, involved, that it's, you know, that's kind of the basis for its use for what the individual perceives, you know, than the traditional. But I couldn't help. I have a witch on the line.
Do it.
Right. Well, Thorne, I really want to thank you for your time today. I've really enjoyed this.
It's been
very educational, and I really appreciate you spending your time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you guys so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Thorne Mooney, and we've been talking about her new book, Traditional Wicca, A Seeker's Guide. Again, her book is available from Amazon.com. It's a Llewellyn publication. And you can find out more about Thorne by visiting her website, which is thornthewitch.wordpress.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.